This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In recent weeks, grand juries in St. Louis and New York have declined to indict two police officers who killed people while on duty. The officers, Darren Wilson and Daniel Pantaleo, were white men. The victims, Michael Brown and Eric Garner, were unarmed black men. Those cases have stoked new conversations about the role that race plays during encounters with the police. And demonstrations across the country suggest a deep divide between police and the public. We're talking about race in the criminal justice system today, and we'll start the conversation with an examination of the grand jury process. Jeff Welty is with me. He's a professor in the School of Government at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Jeff. Good to
Thank
have
you
here. What is a grand jury? What kind of cases do they consider?
A grand jury is a group of citizens which has the responsibility of deciding whether there's probable cause to believe that a felony offense, a serious offense, has been committed. Here in North Carolina, it's a group typically of 18 citizens, and they consider cases that are sent to them by a prosecutor for consideration.
So just to see whether or not this thing should even go on to a trial, right?
That's right. And almost always, they're considering evidence that the prosecutor has essentially selected, and so typically they find that there is probable cause, and they forward the case for trial. But once in a while, they do what's called returning a no true bill or declining to issue an indictment.
That happens very, very rarely.
That's right. I don't know specific statistics, but I'd say it's less than 1% of the time that you get a no true bill. It happens once in a while, but not very often.
What goes on in that room?
Well, it varies a little bit by state. In North Carolina, which I think this is a pretty unique feature of our system, the prosecutor is not present. It's just the grand jurors, the 18 of them, and they hear from witnesses. And in most cases, the only witness they hear from is the investigating officer. The officer tells them what he or she saw, and the grand jury can ask any questions that they may have. And then the grand jury decides whether there's sufficient evidence to charge the suspect with a crime.
Well, I'm just trying to say, who presides over that? I mean, this officer walks in a room, 18 people are sitting there. Do they have in front of them a case, any kind of details in print? How does that work?
The person who's technically in charge is the foreperson of the grand jury, and they're selected by the presiding judge, who's not present in the room but is sort of available as a legal resource if needed. The only printed information that they typically have is a proposed indictment, which is prepared by the prosecutor's office. So the prosecutor's office sends a stack of proposed indictments. The grand jury has those before them when they hear from the officer. And then if they think the officer's testimony supports probable cause for those charges, they sign off on the indictments and send them back. They also have the option of asking to see an indictment for a lesser charge or returning no indictment at all. But as we just discussed, that's not very common.
It happens all the time. We just took it. So in terms of caseload, it's pretty big. We took a sample from Mecklenburg County recently, 272 cases, all returned indictments, including one police officer. So we took the a group of cases that included one police officer who was ultimately indicted. All 272 returned with indictment. It happened at a rate of one per minute. In fact, less than a minute. One indictment every 52 seconds. That seems like a pretty difficult task. It's pretty complicated business, it seems to me, to be disposing of one a minute.
Well, some of those indictments might have been cases where there were multiple indictments that were issued based on a single set of facts, so it might not have been quite as cursory as that. But the truth is that it's typically a pretty rubber stamp process. It's pretty routinized. The grand jury usually has no reason to doubt what the officer is telling them, and they issue the charges that are submitted in the vast majority of cases.
I made a mistake. It was 276 cases that we're dealing with. So in two cases very recently, one in St. Louis and one in New York, we did see indictments, and those seem to be much more protracted procedures. Why were they different? Why was there all of the evidence was presented in this case and not just the prosecution's case?
Well, prosecutors in those states are present before the grand jury and conduct the proceedings directly in a way that doesn't quite happen in North Carolina. But in North Carolina and across the country, a lot of prosecutors view officer-involved shootings as more complicated, as having greater community interest, and oftentimes, as you can see in the Ferguson case, as involving claims of self-defense or some type of rightful reason for the shooting. And so prosecutors tend in those cases to do a much more thorough process before the grand jury, where instead of just presenting the evidence that supports returning an indictment, they present the grand jury with all the evidence, the inculpatory evidence and the potentially exculpatory evidence, to let the community have a take at the case at an early stage and kind of decide whether it's sufficient on all the facts to go forward or not.
And of course, at the heart of the protest is this is inherently unfair. In this case, Mr. Prosecutor, you have decided that you want to present both sides because why? It's more important. Why is it more important? Why not let it go to the jury? That's been the criticism of
That's right.
Two cases.
And you know, there are a couple of different possible criticisms, in particular of the Ferguson case, that I don't want to express an opinion on. For example, did the prosecutor have his thumb on the scale the whole time and not actually present all the evidence? Well, I don't know. You'd have to read all the transcripts to have a sense of that. But the criticism that it's not proper to have this more thoroughgoing grand jury review, I think, is a little bit misguided. I think that can be appropriate in a case where, unlike the typical criminal case, the evidence of guilt isn't at all overwhelming. It is very close. And maybe even there's an argument that the case shouldn't have been submitted to the grand jury at all. If the prosecutor thought that this was a clear case of self-defense, then no charges were appropriate and it shouldn't even have been submitted to the grand jury. So I think it's possible to view this case either as too much process or too little process.
Yeah, but you can see where the charges of unfairness set in. Why leave that to a prosecutor? We have two grand juries here, two juries that can look at this, a grand jury and a petit jury and a judicial system. Let them decide, not the prosecutor.
Right. And but to be clear, obviously, the prosecutor did let the grand jury decide. That was the point of presenting the 70 hours of testimony to the grand jury. And they were then instructed on the law with the relatively low burden of finding probable cause or no probable cause. And they found no probable cause. It's not that exceptional of a process to follow in a case like this. Here in North Carolina, a few months ago, John David, who's the elected district attorney down in Brunswick County, followed a similar process that did result in an indictment of an officer for an officer-involved shooting. Colin Willoughby, the longtime elected district attorney in Wake County, said he preferred a similar process in kind of community-charged shootings like this. And a recent New York Times story suggested it's the process that most prosecutors use. So it's not that unusual for this type of case, even though it's unusual against the backdrop of grand jury proceedings as a whole.
We're looking at the criminal justice system, the influence of race in that system, and we're talking about it today on The State of Things. Jeff Welty is with me, a professor at the UNC School of Government, and joining us now is Allison Grine, who is a lecturer in the School of Government. And, of course, embedded in all of this is whether or not the system itself somehow has a racial bias. Allison, you helped write a manual that guides attorneys in defending indigent clients, and part of that manual includes statistics on traffic stops and pedestrian stops. So how do you see statistics on race working in at the trial level? Now, we're not talking about indictments anymore in the grand jury process. This is a toolkit for defense attorneys going to trial and using race. How does it work?
Well, first of all, the manual, I think, really will be useful for all court actors in addition to defense lawyers, also for judges and prosecutors and magistrates, to help them to recognize when race may be playing an unlawful role in a criminal case and to help them address that when it does arise. I think in some instances, presenting data is absolutely critical to making out a claim. For example, in the context of making out an equal protection claim, the defendant is going to need to show some discriminatory effect arising from the government's action or policy, and that's going to require a statistical showing almost in every case. In other situations, the data is relevant and useful to help bolster a claim.
But what about doesn't intent play an important part in this, and do statistics, can statistics show intent?
Well, they can in some instances. You're right. It's a prong of an equal protection claim that the officer, for example, had discriminatory intent or purpose in addition to showing that discriminatory effect. And when the pattern, the statistical pattern of effect becomes very stark, our courts have said that can go to purpose. And the seminal case on that is Yikwo v. Hopkins. That's from the 19th century, and that's a case where a number of Chinese immigrants were applying for permits. They wanted to make their living by running laundry services, and over 300 Chinese immigrants applied for that permit and were denied the permit, while every white applicant except for one got the permit. And the United States Supreme Court said there's that stark statistical evidence of a discriminatory effect, and there's really no other explanation at that point other than a discriminatory purpose.
Interestingly enough, though, in a case like that, you could also demonstrate that they were qualified to receive the permit, and perhaps in a court case, I can demonstrate that a crime was committed and it was by this individual. The discrimination happened at the level of stop. I'm paying more attention to communities of color than I am to the crimes they may be or may or not be committing than to those in other communities. So is it too late at the trial level, I guess is my question?
No, I think the trial level is the right time to get that evidence before the courts. And that's why we want to help defenders whose duty it is to raise these claims in most instances to get the evidence before the court.
Today on the State
of Things. And to have a robust hearing.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that on the State of Things. Race in the criminal justice system, Jeff Welty and Allison Grine from the UNC School of Government. I'm going to thank Jeff Welty for being on the program. Thank you, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Allison, we will keep you with us and talk more about whether or not and how to use statistics in criminal proceedings. And we'll continue that conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And when we come back, we'll also talk with the police chief in Graham, North Carolina, to talk about the difficulties of policing in communities. And we'll talk with an activist here in the city of Durham. All of that just ahead on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about race and the criminal justice system in light of events in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island, New York. Jeff Welty was with us a moment ago. Allison Grine is here from the UNC School of Government. And we were talking about using statistics in the trial process, but also throughout the criminal justice system to both detect racial profiling and maybe correct for it. You point to the case, Allison, of JDB versus North Carolina as an example of a suspect's vulnerability. Tell us about that and kind of how that's relevant to this discussion of statistics and when and how they can be used.
Sure. Well, lots of times the standard that we're using is an objective one. For example, did the officer have reasonable suspicion to stop somebody driving down the road or a pedestrian walking down the street? Did the officer have probable cause to arrest? And again, those are objective, reasonable person types of standards. We don't look at the subjective intent. But the question arises when we look at the social science that's mounted about implicit bias, should we be considering the individual's characteristics and the individual's vulnerability? And you mentioned the case of JDB. That's a case that arose out of Chapel Hill, where there was a kid at Smith Middle School suspected of breaking and entering some homes in the Chapel Hill area. He's brought into the principal's office, and the principal and school resource officer are present there. And the issue is he in custody? Again, that's an objective standard, and it's very important because that's when these constitutional protections kick in. And the United States Supreme Court said, you know what, we need to consider his age. We need to consider his youth in this question of whether or not he was in custody. So that's an example of the court saying the individual's characteristics actually do matter.
So the reason this is relevant is he made some statements. He wasn't technically in police custody, so of course he hadn't been read his Miranda rights, but he made some incriminating statements to the principal. Question is, well, if you were technically in custody, you should have been read your rights. Therefore, those statements would be excluded. And what we're looking at is, does a high school student in the principal's office feel like they're in custody? And if that's their subjective impression of where they are, then should they have been read their rights? Have I interpreted that, the question, right?
Right. Or were there, for example, as a black youth on the street and two white police officers approach him, should it be relevant? For example, if there's a strained relationship with the police in that neighborhood, should that young person's experience be relevant to this supposedly objective inquiry of whether or not he's been seized? So we do have some courts around the country starting to consider that.
And you can see, especially when you see all of the social sciences about the way prejudice is built in, they are unintentional, they are subterranean, but they are powerful. And we've seen all the data So on the one hand, the evidence is profound and pretty much unassailable. On the other hand, how does this work in a court process once we start trying to weigh these subjectivities in a nominally objective process? Although we understand how much the subconscious and theater plays in a court proceeding. But again, technically, how do you do this? How do you weigh subjectivity in a court proceeding?
Well, that's a good example. The defense may need, for example, to bring in experts about implicit bias and about the role it plays, or at a minimum, to introduce these kinds of social science studies. We've seen some judges who actually instruct jurors on the role that race may be playing in the proceeding and ask the jurors to engage, for example, in a race-switching exercise. Might you be looking at this evidence differently if the race of the defendant and the victim were switched?
And there are three hurdles when we talk about even intent, discriminatory intent, apart from statistics. Tell us about the sort of the three hurdles that you have to jump in order to prove intent.
Are you thinking about the kind of evidence that might go towards intent?
Right.
Right. Well, for example, the statistical evidence that we've been talking about, but the kind of evidence that the defense, of course, most wants to have is some sort of explicit statement by the officer of discriminatory intent. That doesn't happen all the time, but it has happened. We have a North Carolina case, State versus Vieta, where the officer said, if they're driving and they're Hispanic, then odds are they're drunk. So sometimes those explicit statements are made, or the officer stops the car. What are you doing in this neighborhood, which is a predominantly white neighborhood? We have Justice Sotomayor recently rebuking a prosecutor for the prosecutor's jury argument. You have a bag of money. You have some Hispanics. What do you think is going on here? The prosecutor intimating that this was a drug sale situation. So sometimes you have that kind of explicit evidence of the discriminatory intent. Other times you're going to look towards that statistical pattern, or you may be able to get internal affairs records if the officer has engaged in some racially motivated conduct and has been reprimanded for that. Some law enforcement agencies have citizen complaint processes set up where citizens can file a complaint, which the law enforcement agency keeps on record of the officer's racially motivated conduct. If there are a number of complaints against that officer, that would be relevant information for the defender in this case.
Let's see how all of this plays out on the ground. The point at which many adults first encounter police officers is during a pedestrian or a traffic stop. A 2012 study shows that African-American and Latino drivers are nearly twice as likely to be searched and arrested during a traffic stop in North Carolina. More defendants are using those statistics to argue racial bias and that it played a role. Joining us now is Jeff Pritchard. He's chief of police in Graham, North Carolina, and Region 5 director of the North Carolina Association of Police Chiefs. Chief Pritchard, welcome to State Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Reverend Mark Anthony Middleton, pastor at Abundant Hope Christian Church in Durham. Welcome back, Mark Anthony. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Chief Pritchard, we've been talking about the point of contact between civilians and officers. What's the protocol in your department for when to stop an individual, either on foot or in a car?
It's always been the same, but Frank, it's going to be reasonable suspicion that a criminal activity is happening or is about to start happening or is imminent to be happening. That standard has always been the same across the state, and it hasn't changed.
Yeah, you've been a police officer for 23 years, and I just wonder, from your point of view, describe the frame of mind an officer might have in the case. Let's go to Staten Island. Let's go to Ferguson. Put us in the shoes of a police officer in those cases.
I'm not sure of the question, Frank.
Well, for the case of Michael Brown or Eric Garner, if we're talking about Ferguson or in Staten Island, there have been a number of protests about how the police conducted themselves. If you're a police officer, what are you looking at in a case like that? Let's talk about enforcing a law. There's a law against selling cigarettes individually. This is a Staten Island case in which someone is apparently breaking a law. And I'm an officer of the law, and my job is to stop you. All right. So at that point, there's reason to approach that individual.
Certainly, it sounds like I'm not that familiar with Staten Island case, but it sounds like the officer had reasonable suspicion that the law was being broken, that the illegal sales of cigarettes What transpired from that point forward? It seems like there was some type of encounter, obviously, that they had to, that the officer put hands on the individual, and of course we know the outcome, that he was.
Well, let's talk about statistics, I mean, because that's really the what we're dealing with here. How do you use statistics at all in your department? Do they matter? Do they weigh into your management of the police department?
Certainly. We use the traffic stop data report, that is the State Bureau report that we turn in each month on each and every traffic stop that we're required to do. And we look at those monthly, as well as we have an early warning system built into our system that any officers that's complained on sends a certain warnings to supervisors so we know when an officer has any kind of pattern or any kind of misconduct.
Have you ever seen that kind of a pattern, and have you ever pulled an officer aside?
We have not. I have looked at video. I also look at all our in-car video personally. I recently had one that I had questions about, and I did research it and come to find out it was legitimate. But, yes, we look at our video cameras every day and also our traffic stop data monthly to make sure that that things are run appropriately.
What are you looking for? What would cause you to pull an officer aside?
Something like an inordinate amount of officer has a predominantly stopping a minority of some sort or searching minorities or searching a disproportionate amount. In our opinion, we would pull that person aside. We'd pull that data, and I'd be quite frank with you. That's something we do not tolerate in any way.
Have you seen that? I mean, is it possible? In other words, if I have pulled over more Latino drivers, I think in Graham, North Carolina. There is an immigrant population who lives there.
Yes, sir.
Roughly 10%. So do you have a threshold? Do you say to yourself, well, if it's 10% of the population, then no more than 10% of your stop should be a Latino American?
No, I think that's a flawed logic to look at it like that. It would simply be a case-by-case basis. And certainly, as well as we mentioned earlier, that we have citizen complaints, and we take complaints, anonymous complaints. We take them on telephone, email, letter, in person. You know, we take all complaints and we thoroughly investigate all complaints.
Reverend Middleton, you were part of the push to change the policy at the Durham Police Department. That agency now requires officers to get written consent for a search. First of all, how valuable? What's the value in that? And how valuable is that, do you think?
Extremely valuable. Extremely valuable. We took very seriously the numbers and the statistics showing patterns. I think the quote was stark statistical evidence of a discriminatory effect, a la Professor Grimes. We took those numbers very seriously. We need more data points. We're at a wait and see place now. We're waiting 6 months to a year to see if the numbers have changed, because this was a science based movement, a research based movement. But we're extremely optimistic. I think it was extremely important. It was important because oftentimes the critique that there's a systemic and cultural problem loses steam at the operational level. I think around our nation, a lot of people acknowledge, well, we have a statistic, a systemic and cultural issue. But when we engage in activism, when we engage in trying to change the system, the conversation oftentimes devolves into let's get rid of this chief. Mm. Let's get justice for this particular family, as opposed to attacking actually the system and the culture. Chiefs come and go. We get justice for one family, but the numbers remain. And I think what was critical in Durham is that we made the research, science, if you will, the centerpiece of our campaign, which was really the highest form of respect and service, I think, to the families who had experienced horror stories.
Do the statistics statewide, I'm talking about now, not here in Durham anymore, mm-hmm. but statewide, it's pretty compelling when you think about the fact that African-American and Latino drivers nearly twice as likely to be searched and
Absolutely.
Arrested. Does that to you indicate racism?
It indicates, the whole discussion of racism and institutional racism is tricky and it's nuanced. I know plenty of great officers in Durham on an individual basis, black and white, who are just astounding people. But when you suit up, when you put on a uniform, when you get into a group that's possessed of a certain culture, even the most well-meaning individual can at times participate in a dynamic that they don't individually themselves subscribe to as an individual, but this culture takes over. I think we've got a racial issue. Now, I've said time and time again publicly that absent a declaration that black people are just inherently more criminal than everybody else, and I can't find a public official that'll say that. Absent that declaration, then these numbers must mean something. And like I said, I haven't found anybody to make that declaration. So the numbers mean something, and I think they've indicated that we have a problem. And I'm encouraged to hear Chief Pritchard talk about the fact that they're doing data review in Graham. I think that's commendable.
And also taking a look at the video.
Absolutely. A chief doing it personally, I think, is commendable.
And pulled an officer aside because you didn't like the way one stop looked, and you got a good explanation for why that stop was made. But statewide, Chief, given what Reverend Middleton just said, look, the numbers mean something. No, I don't think if I can paraphrase what you said, police officers aren't using racist language or knowingly racist, but there's something about the system, there's something about the way it's structured in which race is playing a part, and these statistics indicate that. Would you agree to that?
I don't know that I would agree to that. I would say that it's criminal profiling is what's happening. You know, I don't know that just because you have a Latino or a black American searched 50% more of the time or twice as likely to be searched on a traffic stop, on a consent search, I suppose. Haven't seen that data. But it's more likely that it's criminal profiling, that there are other circumstances involved for the reason for the stop to begin with. And the officers have information that they've developed and reason for the stop. And that's why I would think. I mean, certainly some of that probably does happen. Yeah, I think our stats, as they are recorded now, are not nearly as inclusive as we'd like for them to be. If we could get some more of that data, that would be more telling.
I just wonder, and again, because some of this builds in not intentionally, some of these beliefs, we'll call them prejudices, build in a way that's not intentional. If you talk about criminal intent, are there ways that these statistics would drive you to reexamine what it is I'm looking for in criminal intent because of the way the numbers are breaking down? Would you be driven to take a look at the way we're looking at our community?
Well, certainly. I think any chief who's worth his salt is going to take a look at those stats and at least on their face and see if there's any validity to it and how they can apply it to their own agency and make their agency a better policing agency for the community that they serve, certainly.
Yeah.
Frank, if I might say, and I don't know that I share the chief's optimism about it's just criminal profiling. Listen, I'm not a law enforcement expert, but I've got significant experience in being an African-American male. That's had interaction with the police. There seem to be outliers that tend to be brown and Latino in nature. By that, I say, let me say this. I watched a rancher point an automatic weapon at federal law enforcement officials last year. And I'm like, you can do that? This white guy and his posse were pointing automatic weapons at federal law enforcement officials. And he went home to tell about it. Eric Garner was selling cigarettes, Lucy's, and he's dead. What do federal law enforcement agents know that the New York City Police Department doesn't know and other police departments? What training did they receive that you can point a gun at them and that person goes home and this guy is selling cigarettes in Staten Island and he's dead? And, you know, with all due respect to the chief, I believe that the overwhelming majority of our police officers are good people. But these outliers come up again and again and again. The outcomes for black and Latino people, citizens, seem to be different. We die. Other folk go home. We sell cigarettes. We die. We point automatic weapons at law enforcement officials. You go home.
Or toy weapons.
Or toy weapons. And I don't want to oversimplify the discussion. I know that there are nuances in discussions. But these anecdotes, these things come up again and again and again. And to say that the numbers, well, don't necessarily mean racism or there's more to the numbers, respectfully, that's what I tell merchants about my credit score. Well, you know, the numbers, there's more to the numbers. It needs some explanation and nuancing. But the numbers mean something. And we need to have that discussion in the country.
What about the effect, too, on communities? Certainly, we have seen polarization. I mean, this goes back to the O.J. Simpson case. We see the division among white and black Americans in terms of how they perceive the criminal justice system. 80% of the African Americans who thought he was innocent, 80% of whites. And that goes all the way through Rodney King and in these two cases as well. Chief Pritchard, does this present a problem for you? Do we have two communities, and is there a problem of perception that poses a problem for law enforcement agencies and the system itself?
Well, you know what they say about perception, that if it's a perception, then there's some validity to it. We need to address it, whether it's true or not. We need to be concerned about it. I think it does pose a few very significant issues for us. As law enforcement officers, we need to recognize that that is the perception, whether it's completely true or or if parts of it are true, we need to be aware of it and take every step we can to address it.
And the level at which, I mean, I'm looking for the numbers here, but over four, I'm looking at 2011, I've got statistics, they're not complete. There were over 400 killings by police officers in the line of duty. Most of them legitimized or not prosecuted, compared to 6 in Germany, 2 in England, and there was, and I think 3 in France. So the way in which we're using lethal force in this country compared to other developed countries who have their share of problems, big slums in London, lots of immigration in Germany, should we examine the way, the rules by which and under which we use lethal force?
That's a question that could be, I guess, addressed on a few fronts. You know, North Carolina General Statute 15A401 gives police officers the authority to use force, lethal and non-lethal force, based on the situation, to defend themselves or a third party from what they believe to be the use of force or imminent use of deadly force. That's what we go by. It's been on the books since early in Tennessee versus Garner case in the early 70s, and North Carolina law is actually one that's been often cited and used to, in upholding cases of deadly force because it's such a well-written law. But as far as your question is, you know, maybe relooking at that, you know, law and how we authorize use of deadly force, I don't know that I would have much to say about that.
We are out of time for this conversation, but the conversation does continue on the state of things, and I want to thank Jeff Pritchard, Chief of Police in Graham, North Carolina, Region 5 Director for the North Carolina Association of Police Chiefs. Thanks, Chief, so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Also, Mark Anthony Middleton, pastor at Abundant Hope Christian Church in Durham. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Coming up, we're going to talk about forbidden music in Nazi Germany on the State of Things. Stay tuned.